Hey there, fellow travelers. Welcome to the Tolkien Road, episode 315. Greta, you ready to wrap up our Silmarillion 2022 journey?
I think so.
Yeah.
I think so. It's been a long time coming.
Yeah.
You know, we had a lot of stuff kind of in the middle of it. It wasn't a straight shot.
In particular, the Rings of Power.
Yeah, which will kind of be talking about,
which we're going to be discussing today.
Yeah.
You know, as we were reading this chapter, I was thinking to myself that the show is really you know, I don't think they had the rights to any of this in terms of, you know, the TV rights to it, but it's almost you know, it feels like a lot of it is very taken from this chapter.
It does. Yeah, I was thinking the same thing.
And honestly, if they were going to make them, if they were going to make that show, then I wish they'd had the rights to this so they could use all the stuff in here. But anyway, that's, I don't want to make this a Rings of Power TV show episode.
No, me either.
All right. In this episode, we will be discussing of the Rings of Power and the Third Age, the synoptical saga of Middle-earth's history through the Second and Third Ages, and the last chapter of the Silmarillion. Before we get started, we'd like to have a double up air five to our patrons. 3, 2, 1.
Whoopsh!
Nice.
That's good. Huh?
Oh, what was that?
That's a good one.
Oh, I thought you said, oh. I was like, okay. Special thanks to this episode's executive producers, John R., Caitlin of Tea with Tolkien, Jacob Lockham, John H., Scotchy Bobo, and Eru27. Thank you all so much. Thank you to all of our patrons. If you would like to become a patron by visiting Patreon, you can become a patron by visiting patreon.com/TolkienRoad. Your financial support helps the Tolkien Road to keep on evering on and land you some cool perks along the way. Learn more at patreon.com/TolkienRoad. YouTube, hit that like button. Don't forget to subscribe and let us know what's on your mind in the comments below. Okay, so our quote of the week comes from Christopher Tolkien's foreword to the Silmarillion, in which he says, "Akalabaeth and of the Rings of Power and the Third Age are included according to my father's explicit intention, and by their inclusion, the entire history is set forth from the music of the Ainur in which the world began to the passing of the Ringbearers from the havens of Mithland at the end of the Third Age." So this is the one section that will actually feel pretty familiar to you if you've only read The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings. Lots of Gandalf actually involved in this one, toward in the second half of it. You know, And reading that, it really made me realize, like, one thing, it probably would have been good to say at the very beginning of all of this, but, you know, I guess it's just an overall insight of having gone through the Silmarillion again this year. This, the Silmarillion, the book, the Silmarillion, is really like, you could almost think of it, it's like your one-stop shop for all things Middle-earth, right? Because it contains, you know, we think of Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit being the primary works of Middle-earth, but really, like, the Silmarillion, as it is the, from the very beginning to the very end, the whole history of Middle-earth in one book, right? And it doesn't mean it's, like, all the details of those histories necessarily. But it's kind of like you could almost use it as a jumping-off point, right? Or, you know, you can kind of read these different, you know, short versions of these stories and then jump off into longer versions of them in many cases.
Yeah.
So in this case, jumping off into Lord of the Rings, in the case of a lot of the stories in Quintus Silmarillion, you have longer versions that have since been published. Yeah. So, anyway.
It's kind of like an eagle eye view.
Yeah, yeah, in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So, you know, if you're a Tolkien fan, hopefully by now you realize that the Silmarillion belongs on your bookshelf. Mm. So, all right, let's dive into Of the Rings of Power and the Third Age. So this final chapter of the Silmarillion is really something completely separate from the rest of the book, an age-spanning synopsis of the events leading up to and including The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings. With this chapter, Tolkien connects the legends of the Silmarillion with the events of The Lord of the Rings, and we learn a great deal of the historical background to Tolkien's magnum opus. So, yeah, and, you know, synopsis, what does that mean? Well, it just means like a summary. So you're, you know, you're summarizing, if Calibeth was a summary of 3,000 years with the fall of Numenor. This actually takes, and it talks about the fall of Numenor, but it's, the focus is more on what's happening back in Middle-earth during that same period, and then after the fall of Numenor, everything that's happening for the next 3,000 years up to and through Lord of the Rings. All right. So, this bad boy spans like 6,000 years of Middle Earth history, right? 3,000 years for a Calabath, 6,000 years plus here. Once again, Appendix B of Lord of the Rings is your friend. So look at, you know, if you kind of take Appendix B of Lord of the Rings, it's got those nice timetables in there. You get the Second Age timetable and you get the Third Age timetable as well. So those can be handy companions for understanding when things are happening as well. The other thing I'll say is this is a great lore chapter. As I was rereading it and then earlier this week and then re-listening to it today, I was just struck by how much background, how much of the lore that isn't explained necessarily in as much detail in like Lord of the Rings is actually explained in a good bit more detail here. So, for example, like, you know, you learn a good bit more about the Rings of Power and how they came to be and how the Nazgul came to be. You learn more about Sauron. You learn about the Palantiri. You learn how Minas Ithil became Minas Morgul. You get more background on the Istari, of, you know, Gandalf and Saruman and Radagast. We get a lot more info on Dol Guldur and the White Council. I mean, and I could go on, right? Yeah. There's a lot of things in here like this. So it's a really interesting chapter, really enjoyable chapter from a lore perspective. Just knowing more about like some of these open-ended questions that you don't necessarily get answered in Lord of the Rings. All right. So, you know, let's hit the high points of this chapter and some of the key passages here. Greta, would you read this passage about Sauron's kind of story that leads up to this?
Sure. But it was not within the power of Eonwe to pardon those of his own order, and he commanded Sauron to return to Amon and there receive the judgment of Manwë. Then Sauron was ashamed, and he was unwilling to return in humiliation and to receive from the Valar a sentence, it might be, of long servitude and proof of his good faith. For under Morgoth his power had been great. Therefore, when Eonwe departed, he hid himself in Middle-earth, and he fell back into evil, for the bonds that Morgoth had laid upon him were very strong.
Yeah, I mean, this one passage in and of itself feels like it could be a whole long story, you know?
Yeah.
What happened with Sauron? And, you know, Sauron was a really, really bad dude in the First Age. Mm-hmm. He did a lot of truly horrendous, awful things in the service of Morgoth. And, but it's interesting that, like, I feel like it, and there was part of this passage we didn't read that says, that there was a lot of people that really thought that Sauron was truly, truly sorry, right? That he was truly sorry for the things that he had done, that he was truly willing to repent. But it's apparently just this unwillingness to humble himself, you know, that was in question here. You know, which gets into really interesting dynamics of like, you know, first, on one hand, what does it mean to be truly sorry? Or, you know, especially if you've done really awful things like he did. Shouldn't you be willing to do just about anything, right? Within reason, right? Shouldn't you be like, I deserve humiliation, right, for what I did? But it also kind of asks on the flip side of that, it's like, should somebody like Eonwe or Manwë be like, give him more freedom to work it out in terms of saying like, I believe you're truly sorry, now prove you're truly sorry, right? It's kind of like almost like a instead of having to come before the Valar, it's like almost like probation or something like that, right? Mm-hmm. Now, that may, you know, I'm sure there were people that argue that that's way too soft, right, for all the things that he did. But at the very least, it, you know, this is the kind of thing that I feel like Tolkien, this is a story I could have seen Tolkien writing a longer, like, unfinished tale on, right? A story that just kind of stands alone and belongs in unfinished tales. You know, the repentance of Sauron or, you know, Sauron's sorrow, and it's just like a study, you know, in the dynamics of like being sorry when you've done something really awful. So anyway, it's a question mark. It does seem to be a question mark here. Was Sauron was Sauron at a point where he truly was wanting to turn things around and be good? And and if that is the case, then exactly what happened? So
yeah, that's a good point.
All right. So we learned a little bit later that Sauron, you know, of Sauron's involvement in the creation of the Rings of Power. So this is a little bit of a longer passage. Greta, we'll go back and forth in reading this. I'll start it, and then we'll switch paragraphs.
Okay.
It was in Eregion that the counsels of Sauron were most gladly received, for in that land the Noldor desired ever to increase the skill and subtlety of their works. Moreover, they were not at peace in their hearts, since they had refused to return into the West, and they desired both to stay in Middle-earth, which indeed they loved, and yet to enjoy the bliss of those that had departed. Therefore they hearkened to Sauron, and they learned of him many things, for his knowledge was great. In those days the smiths of Austin Ethel surpassed all that they had contrived before, and they took thought, and they made rings of power. But Sauron guided their labors, and he was aware of all that they did, for his desire was to set a bond upon the elves and to bring them under his vigilance.
Now the elves made many rings, but secretly Sauron made one ring to rule all the others, and their power was bound up with it, to be subject wholly to it, and to last only so long as it too should last. And much of the strength and will of Sauron passed into that one ring, for the power of the elven rings was very great, and that which should govern them must be a thing of surpassing potency. And Sauron forged it in the mountain of fire in the land of shadow. And while he wore the one ring, he could perceive all the things that were done by means of the lesser rings, and he could see and govern the very thoughts of those that wore them.
But the elves were not so lightly to be caught. As soon as Sauron set the one ring upon his finger, they were aware of him. And they knew him, and perceived that he would be master of them, and of all that they wrought. Then in anger and fear they took off their rings. But he, finding that he was betrayed and that the elves were not deceived, was filled with wrath. And he came against them with open war, demanding that all the rings should be delivered to him, since the elven smiths could not have attained to their making without his lore and counsel. But the elves fled from him, and three of their rings they saved, and bore them away and hid them.
Now these were the three that had last been made, and they possessed the greatest powers. Narya, Nenya, and Vilya, they were named, the rings of fire and of water and of air, set with ruby and adamant and sapphire. And of all the elven rings, Sauron most desired to possess them, for those who had them in their keeping could ward off the decays of time and postpone the weariness of the world. But Sauron could not discover them, for they were given into the hands of the wise, who concealed them and never again used them openly while Sauron kept the ruling ring. Therefore the three remained unsullied, for they were forged by Celebrimbor alone, and the hand of Sauron had never touched them. Yet they also were subject to the One.
Now, I have to point out, again, reference, you know, and I will make some references to Rings of Power where it's appropriate. The three rings, it says clearly they were made last. And in the show, they're clearly made first. You might say, well, maybe Sauron already made the ring. No, he couldn't, because the one ring is forged in the fires of Mount Doom, and Mount Doom had literally just been created in the story of the show. So, lore fail there for Rings of Power. All right. Yeah, but I just love passages like these, because it really has you pondering, like, what does it mean that, kind of how would that work, that Sauron with this one ring is able to view the minds of all these other individuals, and you overlap that too with the idea of the Palantiri. And these seeing stones that the Numenoreans had been given, and it's interesting to think about. Like, first, like, you have Sauron pouring himself, his own power, into the One Ring, and you hearken back to Morgoth and think about him pouring himself into all of his kind of vile manipulations, like, that aren't quite subcreations. They're like, you know, they're like evil subcreations, right? And how that, like, makes him sort of his power diffuse, right? He's like put his power into this other thing, into these other things, and that makes him on an individual basis less powerful apart from them, right?
It's like the Horcruxes.
Yeah. And there's just a lot to be pondered here about the metaphysics, if you will, of the rings, right? What makes them work what is Tolkien getting at with using this idea of having a One Ring and all these other rings and this One mm-hmm. Ring that governs them all? The idea that the three Elven rings somehow help preserve the beauty of what elves are capable of doing, right? Like of what elves do for the world. Mm-hmm. And how when the One Ring, we learn later, when the One Ring is destroyed, it kind of like destroys the power of the other rings as well.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, there's just a lot of like, there's a lot of deep thought that should be going on with this and trying to, you know, kind of recover what Tolkien had in mind here. And, you know, I don't know of any like really, there are probably some really good explorations of this, of these ideas, but I've never really read any that I'm like, that's a really interesting exploration of like the metaphysics of, the rings, right? Of mm-hmm. the rings of power, like how they work.
Mm-hmm.
Because mm-hmm. I don't believe for a second that Tolkien hadn't thought deeply about this himself.
I mean, how could he not have? I mean, it's basically like the, it's called the Lord of the Rings, right? I mean,
yeah,
it's the core of his, you know, most famous work. What I think is what really kind of jumped out to me in this passage was that it was the elves who were aware of Sauron. Like as soon as he put that ring upon his finger, they were aware of him.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't mention that anybody else was, right? Just the elves.
Right.
So there's obviously some kind of connection, right, between mm-hmm. the elves and the, you know, whatever power is kind of embedded
mm-hmm.
in the One Ring that they would be able to recognize it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and we see that as well, kind of a compare contrast with the Rings of Power show. It says, those who had the Elven rings in their keeping could ward off the decays of time and postpone the weariness of the world.
Yeah.
And if I remember from the Rings of Power, the way they had put it was, it's almost like life or death for the elves, right? And I just don't, like, I think there's something similar, but it's almost like it's not quite the same thing to me. So I don't want, and again, I don't want to really dwell on that right now, but, you know, warding off the decays of time and postponing the weariness of the world, this is not necessarily like we're all gonna die. Like if we don't do something, you know, if we don't mm-hmm. harness this mithril, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you know, to help us out here.
It never mentions mithril here either.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think you're right. So, well,
no, we're done. this is not gonna turn into a rag on the Rings of Power show.
Well, again, I just want to compare and contrast where it's appropriate because we did just watch the whole first season mm-hmm. and we're reading this chapter mm-hmm. right now and so much of it is related to what's in that show. Mm-hmm. So
I did find it very interesting though that it does say that the rings are tied to, like you said, to the kind of the wellspring of life
mm-hmm.
in the elves, right? That they do in a way keep them from fading.
Yeah.
But I don't know.
Yeah, I mean it gets back to that whole, you know, you go back to the Waldman letter and it's machine/magic, right?
Mm-hmm.
That Sauron somehow devised a mechanism. And maybe it's not important that we understand the mechanism necessarily of how he did this. But I do feel like there's something here that I am not capable of really addressing, right, you know. But that there's like maybe an ancient view of the world and of like, you know, kind of the alchemist view of the world, right? A pre-modern view of the way of like harnessing natural forces to one's own, you know, to one's own ends, right?
Mm-hmm.
To, you know, even to evil ends, right? People did that even before the modern age, right? We're maybe more efficient at it in certain ways and better at it. And we've built crazy technology kind of off the idea of machines and magic. But Tolkien closely relates those two ideas. And he's talking about the rings when he talks about Sauron's obsession with magic and the machine.
Mm-hmm.
So
how can it be, though, that, I mean, it says clearly there that the three remained unsullied.
Mm-hmm.
For they were forged by Celebrimbor alone,
mm-hmm.
and the hand of Sauron had never touched them. Yet, they were also subject to the one. Like how that in and of itself just seems to contradict itself, right? Like if they were unsullied and the hand of Sauron had never touched them, how are they still connected and subject to the one?
Well, I think that Sauron, if my understanding is that Sauron taught them about the making of the rings, right? Like kind of taught them the
kind of the art or the,
like the theory behind it, maybe.
Okay. Okay.
And so maybe in the, and sort it's,
again, it's liken metaphysics.
I'll try to liken it to something new, right? All right. So something like that, maybe it's easier for us to relate to these days, especially for me because I do this for a living. But I think about, like, I build a lot of websites, right? And I use all of the technology that goes along with building websites, which is basically code, right? Now, I am not a mastermind, you know, one of these like trailblazers when it comes to building like websites, right? Like I wasn't there for the birth of HTML and JavaScript and CSS for all the geniuses that thought these things up in the first place, right? But I've learned a lot about it along the way, right? And I have a pretty good grasp of how to build a website, right? I've built many of them. So you can kind of think about like the masterminds in that case who like thought up these things originally. Mm-hmm. They could probably, like I could probably think like build a website and be like, oh, this thing's super secure. I've got all the right securities in place. And then these guys can come along and be like, have no 15 different ways to actually get around the security I think's in place. And they're, and not because many people can do that, but because they understand like the vulnerabilities that exist, right? Mm-hmm. Because they invented the technology, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah, that's a good analogy. Yeah.
Maybe that's a way to think about it.
Yeah.
You know, that it's like the genius that invents the, and Sauron, I mean, he's kind of the genius that invented this technology of the rings of power, right?
Yeah.
And he worked with some other geniuses for sure, and taught them a lot of things, but he wasn't involved in the actual, so you can be like, he taught them lots of things, but then they went and made these things and he's like, excellent. They're doing exactly what I wanted them to. They're using my theory to do it. And now I can exploit it. Mm-hmm. Right now I know I have all the back doors into these things, right? Mm-hmm. I know all the back doors into these things because I created the technology in the first place. So anyway, it's a really fascinating sort of thing to, another fascinating thing to do a deep dive. And again, you know, who knows how long we'll keep doing the show. Maybe one of these days we'll get to that point where we do a deep dive on it, or maybe I'll, you know, put it into a future book I write or something like that. Explore
that's
that.
That's a good idea. Yeah.
Okay. So let's talk about men. And so we've talked a little bit about the elves, and this actually, there's a little bit about dwarves in here as well. Actually, a decent amount about dwarves and their involvement in the Rings of Power. And it's funny, the dwarves are kind of like Sauron. It's not like they try to hide from Sauron, but it's like Sauron can't read their minds. So he has to kind of go about like controlling them in a different way. But here's what it says about men. Men, I mean, we're kind of weak compared to the dwarves and the elves when it comes to these the power of these rings. So, Greta, you want to read this passage?
Men proved easier to ensnare. Those who used the nine rings became mighty in their day, kings, sorcerers, and warriors of old. They obtained glory and great wealth, yet it turned to their undoing. They had, as it seemed, unending life, yet life became unendurable to them. They could walk if they would, unseen by all eyes in this world beneath the sun, and they could see things in worlds invisible to mortal men. But too often they beheld only the phantoms and delusions of Sauron. And one by one, sooner or later, according to their native strength and to the good or evil of their wills in the beginning, they fell under the thraldom of the ring that they bore and under the domination of the one which was Sauron's. And they became forever invisible, save to him that wore the ruling ring, and they entered into the realm of shadows. The Nazgul were they, the ringwraiths, the enemy's most terrible servants. Darkness went with them, and they cried with the voices of death.
Yeah, so we see Sauron's manipulation of the nine men in this case. You know, it has to do with the same things, the ways he manipulated the Numenoreans, right?
Exactly.
And deceived them. This promise of immortality, right? When we see that, that's really a bad thing for men, right? That's not a good thing for men. Our mortality, our not being bound to this world for the duration of this world, is actually a gift. And when we seek to circumvent that gift, it actually becomes, sort of a living death, right? So not a pleasant thing to think about. And again, this just gives me a little more fodder for what we were talking about before. It's interesting to think about, like, the idea, like all these spiritual ideas sort of being bound up within these rings as well. And let's stop there for a minute, because we talk about spiritual things and we automatically want to go to, thinking that those are just ideas, that's all they are. They're just mental conceptions that we have, and that the only things that really matter are material. But that's not the underlying, metaphysic that underlies what Tolkien's thinking about anything, right? Tolkien believed in a very real spiritual world. And this can be a little bit jarring when you realize this, if you're coming at it like we all are as moderns, right? Because we do think more in material terms. Even those of us who profess to believe in, a very real spiritual world, like, we still tend to think of, like, ideas like prestige and these sorts of things as being just ideas. But you think about Sauron and what it says about him pouring himself into this one ruling ring, right? And you think about, Sauron is a spirit, right? He's an embodied spirit, but his body is not actually a part of him in a final way, right? Like our bodies are, right? He is a pure spirit, just like the other Maiar, just like the Valar. He puts on different guises to make himself appear as he wants to appear, right? Just like we might put on clothes, to appear as we want to appear, right? But he's pure spirit. And so when he's putting in these ideas, of prestige, immortality, unending life, just kind of the things, think about political sorts of ways that people in political power use their skills to control people, right? They'll just all, again, I can't go into this, and I feel like I'm kind of bumbling over myself as I try to explain this, but you think about all the ways in which politicians, how does this person stay there, right? How does this person stay in power, right? Like, they've been at it so long. What is it about them? And the more time you think about it, you're just like, they really understand how to wield power and manipulate people, and kind of, they see this person over here and they're like, I can pit them against this person. And there's a lot of things that go on like that. And so it's like Sauron puts all of those skills that he has into this one ring, right? And those, and that one ring has that back door into all of these other rings of power, right? And maybe think of it as like rings of powers, right? Of all of these powers of control, right? Of domination, right? And he is, through his one ring, controlling all of these others. So the mechanism is there, and it's the rings, right? The ring and the rings, right? And the will and the spiritual aspect of it is bound up in there as well. So anyway, I don't know if any of that is making a bit of sense. It's starting to make more sense to me as I talk about it out loud. So maybe one of these days I'll be able to explain it really well. So stay tuned, and patreon.com/Tolkien Road, so you can give me more time to think about it. All right. So Greta, any more thoughts on this passage?
No, I'm just kind of stuck kind of on this, the whole thing about the ring making people invisible and being able to walk, to walk unseen, but then see things in worlds that are invisible to just regular men. So it's like they're entering into this spiritual universe, almost, right? Like,
yeah.
And I don't know. I was just kind of thinking about that in relation to our discussion about Sauron being spirit. So it's almost like by putting the ring on and becoming invisible, like they're in their likeness, they're becoming more like him, in the fact that you know, spirits are invisible, right? So it's like they're losing that kind of connection to their, you know, to their body, to, mm-hmm. to what makes them men. And they're becoming more in likeness to him, which obviously would make him more able to kind of mold them to his will.
Well, that's, I mean, see, I think we're on kind of on the same wavelength. We may just not realize it. Like, there's something very, like, very deep and insightful going on with all of this.
Yeah, for sure.
And that's why I'm kind of like, man, maybe at some point we just need to, like, I don't know. I feel like I know some people that are, like, really, really, like deep, like, philosophers and theologians, and I feel like I need to get them on here, and we need to, like, just figure this all out, how this all works. But you think about, like, the ring wraiths, right? They're wraiths. Mm-hmm. Like, at some point, they lose mm-hmm. their bodies completely, but right. they still exist in the world, mm-hmm. right? They still exist in the world. And it's like Sauron is, like, through the rings, he's able to pour himself directly into these people, right? He's until they still exist, but their will, their agency is gone, right?
Mm-hmm. What makes them who they are.
They're utterly direct slaves of his exactly. will, right? Mm-hmm. And you see how that kind of relates mm-hmm. to what I was saying before,
yeah,
too,
no,
right?
Yeah, it does. Yeah.
You know, when, I mean, I'm just so averse, on a personal level, I'm so averse to, like, giving like, other people control over me in various ways, right? I can sense when something is happening where somebody is trying to get control over me, and I see it happen. And I'm not trying to say, sometimes I think I need to be a little more willing to let people, you know, deal with me. So, I see it happen to so many people where, whatever you want to call it, they sell out, they just give themselves over, to being, manipulated by somebody who's more powerful than them. And there's a trade-off, and they perceive that there's a good trade-off for them, right? Mm-hmm. But in the end, they end up getting thrown under the bus, right? They end up getting thrown under the bus. A great TV show that explores this whole concept is the House of Cards, right? Oh, I mean, yeah. that show was so good at, like, showing how all of this you know, manipulation worked, and how people lose themselves and they're being kind of influenced and promised things by these more powerful people, right? Who are just using them to get more power. Right.
Yeah.
So at the end of the day, it's rings of power, right? Ultimately, the idea of the capital P power, right? Just overall domination, which was the Morgoth thing in the very beginning. But then it's like, but they're also rings of powers. Like they give different powers. And those are the things that are promised. But in the end, it's about the overall capital P power, the domination,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
And that's what Sauron is trying to achieve in all of these mm-hmm. things. I'm going to promise you powers.
Yeah.
Right? To preserve things, to do the things that you'd like to do. Overall,
right.
I am going to be controlling you.
Exactly.
Right? Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. It's a total mind game, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's like, I will give you these powers, but they are going to be subject to my power, mm-hmm. right? Which goes back to what we were talking about, why he refused to go before the Valar in the first place, right? Is because that's what he wanted. He wanted that domination and making himself subject to the Valar and to their sentencing
mm-hmm.
would take that away from him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Think about these bad boys.
Oh.
Right? I mean, like, it's a perfect example, right? So much we can do with these devices, right?
A lot of good too.
With our phones.
Like a lot of good things, yeah.
Yeah, well, a lot of good things, but the longer we go, the more we realize, oh my gosh, it's opening me up to so many bad things and mm-hmm. like to mm-hmm. surveillance, right? Like literally, if somebody wants to know where I am, there's a way to know where I am at any given time, right? Nobody in history has ever had to live with that until these things came along, right? That's what we're talking. I mean, that is the magic machine thing. That's the magic machine aspect of this, right?
Mm-hmm.
You get some powers, but you're giving up other powers. And so now you think about, what is Tom Bombadil all about? Now you're starting to see, you think about Tom Bombadil, what's he all about? He's utterly free, right?
Free from that
living
power.
In the woods by himself with Goldberry, right? In a little house in the old forest. And he's not subject to manipulation because he's spiritually free, right? He's spiritually free. Okay, well, this is a really fascinating discussion the more we get into it, but we're going to move along because we're trying to get through this whole chapter here. All right, so wars lead to the fall of Numenor, Arnor and Gondor are established, and Sauron returns to Mordor, which leads to the last alliance of men and elves. So another several paragraph passage here. We'll go back and forth, Greta. All right. Now Elendil and Gil-galad took counsel together, for they perceived that Sauron would grow too strong and would overcome all his enemies one by one if they did not unite against him. Therefore they made that league, which is called the Last Alliance, and they marched east into Middle-earth, gathering a great host of elves and men. And they halted for a while at Imladris. It is said that the host that was there assembled was fairer and more splendid in arms than any that has since been in Middle-earth, and none greater has been mustered since the host of the Valar went against Thangorodrim.
From Imladris they crossed the Misty Mountains by many passes and marched down the river Anduin, and so came at last upon the host of Sauron on Dagorlad. The battle plain, which lies before the gate of the Black Land. All living things were divided in that day, and some of every kind, even of beasts and birds, were found in either host, save the elves only. They alone were undivided and followed Gil-galad. Of the dwarves, few fought upon either side, but the kindred of Durin of Moria fought against Sauron.
The host of Gil-galad and Elendil had the victory, for the might of the elves was still great in those days, and the Numenoreans were strong and tall and terrible in their wrath. Against Eglos, the spear of Gil-galad none could stand. Against Aiglos, the spear of Gil-galad none could stand, and the sword of Elendil filled orcs and men with fear, for it shone with the light of the sun and of the moon, and it was named Narsil.
Then Gil-galad and Elendil passed into Mordor and encompassed the stronghold of Sauron, and they laid siege to it for 7 years and suffered grievous loss by fire and by the darts and bolts of the enemy, and Sauron sent many sorties against them. There in the valley of Gorgoroth, Anarion, son of Elendil, was slain, and many others. But at the last the siege was so strait that Sauron himself came forth, and he wrestled with Gil-galad and Elendil, and they both were slain. And the sword of Elendil broke under him as he fell. But Sauron also was thrown down, and with the hilt shard of Narsil, Isildur cut the ruling ring from the hand of Sauron and took it for his own. Then Sauron was for that time vanquished, and he forsook his body, and his spirit fled far away and hid in waste places, and he took no visible shape again for many long years.
Yeah, so thus ends the Second Age. Sauron is vanquished at the last alliance of men and elves. And so seems like a happy ending. Quickly, not so much a happy ending thereafter, but at least Sauron for the time being and for a long time is disembodied, and he is kind of the spirit that dwells in waste places and doesn't seem to have a lot of influence over the events of Middle Earth for a while. Of course, we all kind of know from reading Lord of the Rings the story of Isildur's folly. He wants to hold on to the One Ring as Wergild, because obviously Sauron killed his father and his brother, and he is, you know, and also he's like, and he also destroyed my home, right? Numenor, right? And the home of so many others. So, you know, I was thinking about this. I was like, why did he want to do that? Because it seems like if memory recalled, I think it is canonical that, you know, Elrond is urging him to throw the ring into Mount Doom, right? To undo the ring, right? To destroy the One Ring. Mm-hmm. And
It says right there.
Yeah, it does. Right. Yeah. So sometimes I just have to check myself. Am I just remembering that from Peter Jackson's movie, or is that actually in the book? All right. So I thought it was in the book. So Elrond and Círdan, they try to urge him to destroy the One Ring, and he refuses to do so. And his justification is what I just laid out, and he wants to keep this as Wergild and to become an heirloom.
Can you define that word for me, Wergild?
Well, let's look it up here. Wergild.
This I will have as weregild for my father's death and my brother's.
The amount of compensation paid by a person committing an offense to the injured party or in case of death to his family. Yeah, so it's like, here's compensation, you know, it's compensation for his father and his brother's deaths.
Gotcha.
Right?
Okay.
Yeah, I don't know. To me, as I was listening to it this time, you know, while I was mowing the grass, I started thinking about that. I had some good thoughts. Unfortunately, I can't recall them right now. And I feel like I've already stumbled over myself enough in this episode. But I feel like there is something really interesting on a spiritual level there as well that goes just beyond the idea that the ring is manipulating Isildur. Obviously, there's, you know, some aspect of it doing that. Mm-hmm. But this idea, again, Tolkien operates in some... and a lot of ancient concepts that don't necessarily make as much sense to us on a modern level immediately. And so it's worth spending time understanding those in a lot of cases. But his justification, at least, is that he's going to keep it because it's weregild. It's kind of an heirloom mm-hmm. that can be passed down as a reminder of the sacrifice of Elendil and of Anarion, right? And honor them in that way, right? You know, keep their memory alive.
Yeah. I think maybe some of the, the crux of it here is it's interesting where, like, you see the progression of his thought where it's like weregild, right? It's like a memorial to mm-hmm. the people, the loved one he lost. But then that very next sentence is, was it not I that dealt the enemy his death blow? Like, you know, you can just see that whole idea of pride. Like kind of starting to kind of eat away at him there. He was mm-hmm. like, well, I'm the one that killed him. Like I'm entitled to this. Right. So not only is it a memorial of his father and brother's death, but it's like a trophy for mm-hmm. him in a way. Right. And I think that's all it really needs to really start doing its work.
Yeah. It's interesting because I was thinking about it, like this concept of weregild as being like financial compensation for the death. And we all get that, right? If somebody, if your, brother, parent, whatever is killed in a car accident for somebody who's recklessly driving, mm-hmm. you get the idea of, financial compensation for that, right? I mean, there's on a number of levels, right? The damages of that. Now, you can never actually put a dollar price on any human life, right? So that's not really possible. But at the very least, it's supposed to kind of be some compensation, maybe to help with some of the expenses associated with burying that person, hospital bills, whatever, and then just the emotional damages, the loss of income, maybe if a person was helping with, like, there's just so many levels on which you can argue for this being a good thing. Mm-hmm. But those are all very, like, practical levels to help you kind of get back on your feet and move on. This is for Isildur. It's like it's a trophy, right? Mm-hmm. It's it becomes more of a family pride kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And again, you know, it's like, I can see Elrond and Círdan trying to plead with him and being like, the best thing you can do to honor the memory of your father and your brother is destroy the ring because that will destroy Sauron once mm-hmm. and for all. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. But yeah, there's something that's calling to Isildur, mm-hmm. and it's finally ends at, was it not I that dwelt the enemy, his death blow, right? Mm-hmm. I did this, right? So it's a pride thing. It's not actually even about his brother and his father. It's about a pride thing.
That's what I just said.
No, interesting. I'm just echoing it. I'm not taking away any credit from you.
No. Yeah. No, I just think because clearly it's the, it's just that's, yeah, you can just see his slow descent into... and like letting that pride take control. And then he starts, he said, well, it's also exceedingly fair to look on, right? Mm-hmm. He's like, oh, it would be a shame to get rid of this. It's beautiful, you know? So it's just starting to kind of eat away and yeah. work its magic.
He's finding all the reasons not to destroy it, mm-hmm. not to destroy it. Mm-hmm. All right. So the fates of Arnor and Gondor, right? So Arnor and Gondor, they're established here kind of concurrently with the Last Alliance of Men and Elves, and Arnor being the Northern Kingdom. Arnor is where in the Third Age, it's kind of like it's the ancient kingdom and the ancient realm where the Shire is actually located, right? And it grows up, the Shire kind of springs out of the remnants of this northern kingdom of Arnor, right? And it's actually the kingdom that where the main seat of Aragorn ends up being, right, in later times, right, in Arnor. But we have Arnor in the northern kingdom and Gondor in the southern kingdom. Now, they're not divided kingdoms. They are one kingdom, but they're just two different. It's a large area, so it's just two different realms, right? But not politically divided. So let's read a little bit about their fates as the Third Age progresses. Valandil took up his abode in Anúminas, but his folk, and so Valandil is the son, is the only surviving son of Isildur. Valandil took up his abode in Anúminas, but his folk were diminished, and of the Numenoreans and of the men of Eriador, there remained now too few to people the land or to maintain all the places that Elendil had built. In Dagorlad and in Mordor and upon the gladdened fields, many had fallen. And it came to pass, after the days of Eärendil, the seventh king that followed Valindil, that the men of Westernes, the Dúnedain of the north, became divided into petty realms and lordships, and their foes devoured them one by one. Ever they dwindled with the years until their glory passed, leaving only green mounds in the grass. At length naught was left of them but a strange people wandering secretly in the wild, and other men knew not their homes nor the purpose of their journeys, and save in Imladris, in the house of Elrond, their ancestry was forgotten. Yet the shards of the sword were cherished during many lives of men by the heirs of Isildur, and their line from father to son remained unbroken.
In the south, the realm of Gondor endured, and for a time its splendor grew until it recalled the wealth and majesty of Numenor ere it fell. High towers the people of Gondor built, and strong places and havens of many ships, and the winged crown of the kings of men was held in awe by people of many lands and tongues. For many a year the white tree grew before the king's house in Minas Anor, the seat of that tree which Isildur brought out of the deeps of the sea from Numenor. And the seed before that came from Avalane, before that from Valinor in the day before days when the world was young.
So Arnor, over the course of the Third Age, really dissolves from being anything. And it's really, by the time we get to Lord of the Rings, it no longer really exists as anything. Gondor, of course, does still exist, but at some point it loses even its kind of the royal house, right? Because of, and that's why we have the stewards of Gondor as the ones who are ruling in the place of the actual king. So it is interesting because we put so much emphasis on Gondor, but it's interesting to know that Arnor was really like of the same level or even of a greater level, right? Arnor was the seat of Elendil when he was still alive, right? And it's in the northern kingdom. Gondor is more of like the frontier kingdom there to, you know, hold off Mordor, hold off Sauron there.
How much of that do you think has to do with the fact that Gondor had the white tree and Arnor did not?
Really interesting thought. I don't know.
It just occurred to me.
That's a great point.
What, you know, why the success of one and not the other? And that's really kind of a big thing they had, and that, you know.
Well, and I was thinking too, it's really interesting that, so I think that's a interesting note. And to go along with it, Gondor is the one that's closest to all of these enemies, right? I mean, Gondor is right there next to Mordor, right? And it's right on the frontier of all these southern peoples that supposedly hate Gondor and hate Arnor, right? But somehow it holds together over all this time, right? You know, it's seen better days by the time we get to Lord of the Rings, but it's still holding together. Whereas Arnor just dissolves into a bunch of like petty fiefdoms.
Exactly. Yeah, it says petty. They became divided into petty realms and lordships, and it just made me think about, you know, what we've talked about before about how that tree was kind of a memorial of their ancestry, like where they came from. It harkened back to Valinor, right?
Yeah.
And their relationship with the elves, and there is a kinship there. There was a camaraderie. So even just having that symbol there as a daily reminder of where you come from, I think probably goes a long way to establishing the success of a kingdom.
Well, and that's what I was getting at is that I think the constant pressure they were under from Mordor and from the south also lent itself to keeping that camaraderie in place, right? Because it's always like it's Gondor against Gondor against the world, right?
Exactly.
And it's like we're the realm of the White Tree, even if we're not entirely sure what the White Tree is all about anymore.
Yeah.
Right. We're still the realm of the White Tree.
Right.
And
Something that and ties we
know
them together.
And we know that's a good thing. Yeah. We know about the ancient deeds of many of our ancestors, and we got to hold together because we don't have any choice.
Right.
You know, we can't dissolve into all these little petty, petty lordships because we're constantly under attack from outside.
And they have a common enemy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Good stuff. Mm-hmm. All right. Meanwhile, Elrond. All right. So let's catch up with Elrond in the Third Age. In all the days of the Third Age, after the fall of Gil-galad, Master Elrond abode in Imladris, and he gathered there many elves and other folk of wisdom and power from among all the kindreds of Middle-earth. And he preserved through many lives of men the memory of all that had been fair. And the house of Elrond was a refuge for the weary and the oppressed, and a treasury of good counsel and wise lore. In that house were harbored the heirs of Isildur, in childhood and old age, because the kinship of their blood with Elrond himself, and because he knew in his wisdom that one should come of their line to whom a great part was appointed in the last deeds of that age. And until that time came, the shards of Elendil's sword were given into the keeping of Elrond, when the days of the Dúnedain darkened, and they became a wandering people. So, Elrond is, that's how Aragorn really comes to become associated early on in Lord of the Rings, why he's associated with Rivendell. And he's kind of inhabiting this northern realm so far away from Gondor when supposedly he's the heir of Gondor, right? He was part of this line of the true heirs to the throne of Isildur, right, who were taken in by Elrond and kind of raised within his house. And so that's the story on that. So
when I was reading this, I began thinking, I was like, I want my house to be like Elrond's house, where it talked about like a refuge for the weary and the oppressed, a treasury of good counsel and wise lore. I was like, oh, that's something to aspire to.
Yeah.
Right? I mean,
well, it sounds like, it sounds like a monastery, right?
Kind of
in a peaceful place in the middle of nowhere, beautiful sort of natural, peaceful place in harmony with the natural world around it, right? Sounds like a pretty nice place to be.
It does.
For sure.
Yeah.
Could use one of those.
Preserved from all that craziness that's happening, you know, outside of it.
Yeah, it just sounds like the world's greatest retreat house, you know?
It really does. Yep, for sure.
All right. So a little bit more about the fates of the rings. You want to read this passage?
And so indeed it has since befallen. The one and the seven and the nine are destroyed, and the three have passed away. And with them the third age is ended, and the tales of the Eldar in Middle-earth draw to their close. Those were the fading years, and in them the last flowering of the elves east of the sea came to its winter. In that time the Noldor walked still in the hither lands, mightiest and fairest of the children of the world, and their tongues were still heard by mortal ears. Many things of beauty and wonder remained on earth in that time, and many things also of evil and dread. Orcs there were, and trolls, and dragons, and fell beasts, and strange creatures old and wise in the woods whose names are forgotten. Dwarves still labored in the hills, and wrought with patient craft works of metal and stone that none now can rival. But the dominion of men was preparing, and all things were changing, until at last the Dark Lord arose in Mirkwood again.
So we kind of fast forward to the end of the age here. There's still some topics to cover, but we find out the fates of the rings when the One Ring is eventually destroyed at the end of the Third Age. The seven and the nine are also destroyed as well, and the three pass away over over the seas. And what really all of this history of Middle Earth is leading up to after the Third Age is the dominion of men, right? You can almost think of this as like, the stories of Middle Earth is like the prehistory of civilization before really men come into their own, right? The elves are passing away. The elves are passing away, dwindling from this world. And their physical presence in this world, right? Mm-hmm. Though they still have connection, and it's interesting to think about like sort of the idea of Tolkien associating them with like fairies and just kind of like these like ephemeral spirits in our own time, that they've just kind of they're still tied to the world, but they're kind of dimmed and they're no longer very corporeal, right? They're just all they can do is fade and continue to fade, right? And their power is not nearly what it was, you know, many thousands of years ago. So, okay, a little bit on wizards and Mithrandir. In the likeness of men, they appeared old but vigorous, and they changed little with the years and aged but slowly, though great cares lay on them. Great wisdom they had and many powers of mind and hand. Long they journeyed far and wide among elves and men, and held converse also with beasts and with birds. And the peoples of Middle-earth gave to them many names, for their true names they did not reveal. Chief among them were those whom the elves called Mithrandir and Curanir, but men in the north named Gandalf and Saruman. Of these, Curanir was the eldest and came first, and after him came Mithrandir and Radagast, and others of the Istari who went into the east of Middle-earth, and do not come into these tales. Radagast was the friend of all beasts and birds, but Curanir went most among men, and he was subtle in speech and skilled in all the devices of smithcraft. Mithrandir was closest in counsel with Elrond and the elves. He wandered far in the north and west, and made never in any land any lasting abode. But Curanir journeyed into the east, and when he returned he dwelt at Orthanc and the Ring of Isengard, which the Numenoreans made in the days of their power.
Ever most vigilant was Mithrandir, and he it was that most doubted the darkness in Mirkwood, for though many deemed that it was wrought by the Ringwraiths, he feared that it was indeed the first shadow of Sauron returning. And he went to Dol Guldur, and the sorcerer fled from him, and there was a watchful peace for a long while. But at length the shadow returned, and its power increased, and in that time was first made the Council of the Wise, that is called the White Council, and therein were Elrond and Galadriel and Círdan, and other lords of the Eldar, and with them were Mithrandir and Curanir. And Curanir, that was Saruman the White, was chosen to be their chief, for he had most studied the devices of Sauron of old. Galadriel, indeed, had wished that Mithrandir should be the head of the council, and Saruman begrudged them that, for his pride and desire of mastery was grown great. But Mithrandir refused the office, since he would have no ties and no allegiance save to those who sent him, and he would abide in no place, nor be subject to any summons. But Saruman now began to study the lore of the Rings of Power, their making, and their history.
Yeah, so this gives us a little bit, just some of the background on the wizards and their roles. And again, this is, you know, this is history that we just read about here is actually history that predates The Hobbit and Lord of the Rings by several centuries, right? So there's a lot of history to go before all of this. And we see that Sauron is really, he's already operating and returning, you know, working to operate and, you know, much earlier in the Third Age than what we get in The Hobbit and the Lord of the Rings. Mm-hmm. I like to call this section the Lord of the Rings in four paragraphs. So yeah, we'll go with this one. But those who saw the things that were done in that time, deeds of valor and wonder, have elsewhere told the tale of the War of the Ring, and how it ended both in victory unlooked for and in sorrow long foreseen. Here let it be said that in those days the heir of Isildur arose in the north, and he took the shards of the sword of Elendil, and in Imladris they were reforged. And he went then to war a great captain of men. He was Aragorn, son of Arathorn, the 39th heir to the right line from Isildur, and yet more like to Elendil than any before him. Battle there was in Rohan, and Curanir the traitor was thrown down and Isengard broken. And before the city of Gondor a great field was fought, and the Lord of Morgul, captain of Sauron, there passed into darkness. And the heir of Isildur led the host of the west to the black gates of Mordor.
In that last battle were Mithrandir and the sons of Elrond and the king of Rohan, and lords of Gondor, and the heir of Isildur with the Dunedain of the North. There at the last they looked upon death and defeat, and all their valor was in vain, for Sauron was too strong. Yet in that hour was put to the proof that which Mithrandir had spoken, and help came from the hands of the weak when the wise faltered. For as many songs have since sung, it was the
Perianath,
the little people, dwellers in hillsides and meadows, that brought them deliverance.
For Frodo the halfling, it is said, at the bidding of Mithrandir, took on himself the burden, and alone with his servant, he passed through peril and darkness and came at last in Sauron's despite even to Mount Doom. And there into the fire where it was wrought, he cast the great ring of power, and so at last it was unmade and its evil consumed.
Then Sauron failed, And he was utterly vanquished and passed away like a shadow of malice, and the towers of Barad-dûr crumbled in ruin, and at the rumor of their fall many lands trembled. Thus peace came again, and a new spring opened on earth, and the heir of Isildur was crowned king of Gondor and Arnor, and the might of the Dúnedain was lifted up and their glory renewed. In the courts of Minas Anor the white tree flowered again, for a seedling was found by Mithrandir in the snows of Mindoluin, that rose tall and white above the city of Gondor. And while it still grew there, the elder days were not wholly forgotten in the hearts of the kings.
Yeah, so right there, Lord of the Rings, four paragraphs.
Four paragraphs. My
biggest gripe is that Sam gets no love. He's just called the servant of Frodo.
So, yeah, I thought that was a little low.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It could have at least said in his servant Sam, Samwise, right?
Or Sam the... What is he called? Sam the Stout-hearted?
Yeah. It makes me wonder, you know, because often Tolkien would have an explanation for, like, where, like, on a legendarium level, where certain accounts came from. So it makes me wonder, like, who was responsible for this account? And maybe we find out it was Sam. Maybe Sam wrote that particular account, and that's why he didn't put himself in there.
That seems
right?
Very fitting. It seems very in keeping with Sam's character.
That's just speculation. If anybody knows if Tolkien ever spoke about that directly, that would be interesting. Mm-hmm. But we know that that Sam kept the Red Book of Westmarch after Frodo. So it's possible, yeah, that Sam edited, you know, or wrote this final account, and he was content with just being anonymous as the servant of Frodo. So. Which seems very fitting for Sam. This seems very fitting for Samwise. And then we find out the end of the Eldar. So the end of the Third Age is really the beginning of the Dominion of Men, but it's also the end of the Eldar really having a major significance in our world, right? Mm-hmm. Greta, you want to read this?
But when all these things were done, and the heir of Isildur had taken up the lordship of men, and the dominion of the West had passed to him. Then it was made plain that the power of the Three Rings also was ended, and to the firstborn the world grew old and gray. In that time the last of the Noldor set sail from the havens and left Middle-earth forever, and latest of all the keepers of the Three Rings rode to the sea, and Master Elrond took there the ship that Círdan had made ready. In the twilight of autumn it sailed out to Mithland, until the seas of the bent world fell away beneath it, and the winds of the round sky troubled it no more, and borne upon the high airs above the mists of the world, it passed into the ancient west, and an end was come for the Eldar of story and of song.
Yeah, so that is a wrap on the Silmarillion. The elves, they pass out of this world, right, in this case, and we know that there are elves that remain behind, but I think, you know, this is really speaking to a lot of those more significant elves. Of the elves that remain behind, I think those are the ones that maybe, you know, Tolkien would have speculated, like, they kind of become these, like, you know, they just continue to fade until they're almost like nothing to us, right? And, that's kind of associated with the whole idea of, like, you know, going into a forest and, like, just having a sense of, like, things around you and sort of, you know, and that kind of thing. And, like, oh, maybe they're fairies, right? You know, like, kind of the lore of ancient or of old England and that kind of thing. But anyway, it's kind of an interesting mental image to think about, like, the ships that they're passing away from the Great Havens. They're kind of going up. At a certain point, they kind of take off from the seas and go up into the air, right? And that's how they arrive at Valinor in this time, because Valinor is no longer a part of our world, right? It's kind of after the end of the Second Age is broken away and the road is bent, as they say, right? There is no straight road to the Blessed Realm.
So what was it that caused, like, the power of the Three Rings to end?
I think it was because of the power of the One Ring. So maybe, and again, this gets in.
I was going to say, it kind of harkens back to our whole discussion of, like, the metaphysical properties and power of the One Ring.
And maybe the way we should think about the ring is, like, the One Ring is that it's kind of like the overall, it's like the embodiment of all of the mechanism itself. So maybe, like, the ring, you kind of think about the phone, like, you know, this is one of the rings of power, right? But the One Ring is like the internet, right?
Hmm.
Anyway, once upon a time, the internet did not exist and it came to be, right? And so it's this whole ecosystem that involves all of these things, right? And if the internet were to break, like that's the idea, this thing would, mm-hmm. would pretty much be useless at that point,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
If this whole World Wide Web were to just no longer work for whatever mm-hmm. reason, mm-hmm. right? That thing would be useless at that point. It would no longer have the functionality that that makes it something that you want to keep with you all the time. So that's how I'd explain it. That's how I'd explain it.
Yeah.
But again, like you can't just think about it as it's like technology on the level that we tend to think about
right.
technology. There's
so much more.
There's
to
a
it.
Deeper spiritual element going
mm-hmm.
on here.
Mm-hmm.
Honestly, with these things, there's a deeper spiritual element going on too. It's like Tolkien would definitely say that. I have no doubt in his mind. He would say, like, this thing has spiritual qualities to it, right? You put something of yourself into this as you interface with it, right? You have power over things because of that. You have efficiencies over things because of that, right?
Mm.
Those are spiritual qualities. So anyway, like, it's not to say, like, this represents this. It's to say, like, Tolkien's writing a story that seems very different from our own world, but it actually, the ideas are still the same and they're very applicable in our
mm-hmm.
own world. So,
yeah. Well said. Well said.
Okay. Well, good discussion.
It was.
Really good discussion
yeah, it
today.
Was really good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hope
that.
You all enjoyed it as
mm-hmm.
well.
Yeah.
So, hey, now that we're done with the Silmarillion, what's next? So just kind of give you an idea of where, you know, we got a couple more episodes left in 2022. We need to do some mailbag. We haven't done a mailbag mm-hmm. episode in a while, and you know, we probably need to do at least two. One maybe on the Rings of Power reactions, and one on the Silmarillion. You know, thank you for everybody that writes in. There's been so many people who have written in. We just, you know, been very busy, and it's not always possible to respond to everybody. The quickest way to get a response is usually via YouTube, but even then, I'm like pretty behind on a lot of those. So we're going to do a mailbag, probably focus specifically, you know, especially on some of the longer notes we've gotten from folks, and expect those in the coming weeks. I plan to get to Athrubeth Finrada Ondreth this year and do a discussion of that one, because that is actually the one work of Tolkien's that maybe should have been included in the Silmarillion, and he may have wanted it included in the Silmarillion, but did not get included here. So I kind of feel like it's fitting to go ahead and do that one in the same year we did the Silmarillion. Also want to do a non-Middle Earth story. So maybe Farmer Giles of Ham, Smith of Wooten Major, Rover Random, one of those, one of these stories that, we haven't actually discussed on the podcast before. Hopefully an interview or two. I've got some folks that, I've been meaning to interview for a while, and some things fell through earlier in the year. And so want to get back to those and, you know, maybe we'll get some of those out as well this year. And then we'll also do an announcement, you know, about our plans for 2023 and, you know, just share with you kind of the exciting things that we've got planned coming up there. So,
sounds good.
Very excited about that. You know, I have a pretty clear idea of what we're going to be doing in 2023. So stay tuned for more about that. You know, I am working on some new potential books, two books actually, as far as things Tolkien. So, next after Tolkien's Requiem and Tolkien's Overture, early stages of those two things, but hope to make a lot of progress on them in 2023, and who knows, maybe even get one of them out towards the end of the year. So
that's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
good stuff.
A lot more to come. Mm-hmm. A lot more to come. All right, Greta, shall we do a haiku?
Let's do it.
All right. Rock, paper,
scissors,
shoot.
You can go first.
Okay. Today's tragedies, tomorrow's victories, ages as shadows. I think my second line actually was only six syllables.
It is. You cheated.
Tomorrow's victories is.
Victories is.
There you go.
That's good.
Thank you.
I like that. I like the alliteration in the first line. All right, here's mine. Of story and song an end. Hands of the weak help when the wise falter.
Nice.
Thanks.
Good stuff.
Yeah. Gosh, I can't believe it's over. It's for the second time.
I know.
We've done the Silmarillion. It's crazy sauce.
Well, probably won't be doing it again until at least 2027. So, okay. You know, five years since we finished it last. We did it, you know, did it in 1 year this time. But honestly, I don't know. Who knows if we'll ever come back to it on this podcast.
There's so many other things.
Well, there's so many other things. And yeah. If we're going to reread anything, I mean, it's like I'd want to go back and reread Lord of the Rings, which would probably take us like 3 years.
Yes.
Because I would want to do it like way deeper than we did it last time. And who knows? But who knows? We got a lot more, you know, the road goes ever on, right? So lots more to come that we haven't even touched yet in terms of Tolkien's works. Looking forward to all of that.
Mm-hmm. So. For sure.
All right. Well, thanks, everybody. Thanks for going with us on this journey this year.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you to our amazing patrons, especially the following: John R.,
Caitlin of Tea with Tolkien,
Jacob Lockham,
John H.,
Scotchy Bobo,
Eru 27,
Ms. Anonymous,
Andrew T.,
Red Hawk,
Shannon S.,
Brian O.,
Emilio P.,
Zeke F.,
James A.,
James L.,
Chris L.,
Chuck F.,
Azia V.,
Ish of the Hammer,
Teresa C.,
David of Pints with Jack,
Jonathan D.,
Eric B.,
Johanna T.,
Mike M.,
Robert H.,
Paul D.,
Julia,
Werty,
Matthew W.,
Joe Bagelman,
Chris K.,
Jacob S.,
Richard K.,
Matt R.,
Garrett P.,
John W.,
and Eugene D.,
as well as those celebrating their Patreon anniversary in November of 2022, Michael L.,
and Matthew F.
Thank you all so much for your support.
Thank you, guys. Mm-hmm.
Thank you to all of our patrons. We really appreciate you.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks, everybody, for listening. We'll talk at you next time.
Bye, y'all.
Bye-bye.